Good afternoon. So today we're going to finish up talking about cache blocking and move on to some other topics about performance. So cache blocking was this idea that we can control our cache performance by the order in which we access values. So we can do the same computation in different orders, which means we access memory in different orders, which means that we have different numbers of cache hits, because we have different amounts of locality, which is what our cache takes advantage of. Our cache lets us take advantage of temporal locality, where we access values repeatedly, where hopefully we've accessed it soon enough that it's still in the cache. And it lets us take advantage of spatial locality, where we access values which are adjacent. So for example, in this cache block code, we took a case where we have, where previously we had this bij we were accessing once in that innermost loop. If n was really big, we'd access a whole lot of things before we next access bi times n plus j. Now we're accessing it twice in the loop. So we have more locality this way. And in addition, so we have temporal locality in the bijs, and before and after we did cache blocking, we also have spatial locality in the bijs. So here we have, this is temporal locality so repeated access, and we also have some spatial locality. So spatial locality because we access bi times n plus 0, then bi times n plus 1, which are next to each other that we had before. So with this cache blocking, we've added temporal locality in addition to the spatial locality you already had. And we also created more spatial locality in the second term here. So previously, we accessed ai times n plus k, and then we never accessed anything nearby. Now we access ai times n plus k, ai times k plus 1. So these are two things right next to each other. They might be in the same cache block. And so this is going to give us an opportunity to make our code faster. And this was the sort of main motivation we talked about when we did this splitting of this loop to add process 2k values, which is that now we're basically loading twice as much in the cache for using it repeatedly. So in addition to having spatial locality in these values, we're also, we access them every iteration of the loop. We did that before, but now instead of having one value, we access every iteration of this innermost loop, we have two. Yes? So the idea is, so the question is a reminder about rows and columns. The idea is that a of I times n plus j is a row I column j. Okay, got what you were looking for? And that's also same pattern applies to. And that was just sort of the underlying computation. You don't actually need to know that to see if there's locality here. All you need to say is, how much does the index change? Is it something that's going to be next to each other in the A, if I look at it as just a big flat array? That's all you actually need to know for to see what how helpful is this for the cache. And this cache blocking here is, in some sense, a compromise. So I kind of hurt some kinds of locality. So so while I have good locality in all of these of some sort, it's not as good as it used to be. So before I processed 2Ks, I was accessing AIK more frequently, the same element of A more frequently. Now I access twice as many things. I have less temporal locality. So, you know, I'm accessing a particular element of A half as often as I was before. But that's not enough to actually matter because everything fits in the cache. So this is what we're doing with cache blocking, is we're kind of getting a compromise between multiple ways of ordering these loops, is one way of thinking about it. That none of the loop orders, you know, make everything best, but they make one of the parts best. And we're going to make all of them pretty good. So none of the loop orders make us, you know, access one of the elements over and over again. In this case, before we did any blocking, the k's were most spread out. So we would go to the next k, and therefore the next element of ai times n plus k in the longest amount of time. Now we're doing it in less time, and we got this compromise, you know, because we're doing that without actually changing it, so we do k's repeatedly. So we still have the advantages of doing the j's more frequently, incrementing that more often, so we more often go to the next j for the parts of this expression where that matters. So any general questions about this sort of cache blocking? So as I mentioned last time, this actually helps performance in terms of cache misses. And there's two sorts of generalizations we'll do for this. So one thing is that I did it with k, I can do it with other things. I split up the k loop because I wanted to say I want to access multiple k's but not just have to jump around in every other dimension. So I split up the k loop. I can do the same for the I loop. I can say I want to access the two things which are next to each other in two different values of I in this innermost loop, because I think that will let me have more values in my cache. And I think that will give me better performance. So I can try to do that, and I can do this again for J, so I can hopefully get more of a compromise between all the different loop orders. So I can have, hopefully, expose more locality this way. So if we look at what I'm doing here, the extra locality I'm exposing is I'm accessing some parts of A repeatedly, which I wasn't before. So I exposed more temporal locality by doing the same thing I did for the k's, for the i's, accessing not just a little block of two values of k, but a block of two values of k and two values of I, all the combinations. This makes sense, why sort of the advantage I'm getting here. This is just expanding out those loops like I showed before. So we can do this with all our different things we're iterating over. We can split up those loops in order to get this compromised loop order. Another choice we have is that I arbitrarily have a 2 here. There's no reason I had to put a 2 there. I could have put a bigger number. So is there a limit to how big a number I could have put there? Could I put like n divided by 4? Would that be a good idea? What might go wrong? What make that a bad idea? Yeah.
So the cache block only stores a certain amount of adjacent lines or adjacent memory slots. So if you make your I more bigger than the memory slot, it might be
a Yeah. So our cache only stores so much data. And here I'm saying I want you to keep AKJ and AK plus 1J in the cache. If I make that go up to AK plus 2, 3, 4, all the way up to some big number, the cache is not going to keep that around. And I'm going to end up not getting any extra temporal locality here. Because, you know, I'll be accessing it a little more frequently, but not frequently enough that it will stay in the cache. I'll run out of space. So the general procedure for cache blocking looks something like this, that we have this loop over blocks where we choose an amount for each dimension we're splitting up, and then we do a block of that size. And the idea is all the data we're processing in these triply nested innermost loops here, all the data we're processing here, the parts of B and A that we care about, hopefully all can fit in the cache. And so if we're thinking about it from the perspective of planning what I load in the cache, I'm saying I'm planning for some particular things to be in the cache. I don't have a way of saying load this into the cache now, but by only working on that part of my data, I'm going to make sure that the cache takes advantage of the data being small enough to fit in the cache. Okay, so I work across in that size chunks of the data I'm processing and hopefully have very few cache misses, except each time I start at processing a new block and need to load that block's data. And by choosing the block size as large as we can therefore minimize the number of cache misses, is the hope. This idea makes sense? So you'll notice that here, by optimizing my code, I've made it a lot uglier. In fact, so much uglier that it didn't write the real code on this slide. I just wrote pseudocode for those loops. And so this can be quite annoying to write in practice. And usually, if you see code like this in practice, people will often write a helper function like this. So something which does a single block, and then they'll call it in a loop to do that. That would be how, if you have to do this, I would recommend organizing your code, because it is really easy to lose track of all your indices if you don't do that. Okay. And so when you do this sort of full version of cache blocking, where you choose a block in every single thing you're iterating over, and you make sure it fits comfortably in the cache, you can really substantially reduce your miss rate. And this should give you better performance. But you might notice that I've been showing you graphs of miss rates. So this is on my desktop, there's a counter you can access which tells you how many cache misses were there. And I just measured that over a benchmark program. But this is not actually what we care about. We care about performance, and you should be suspicious that why am I not showing performance numbers? Is something wrong with my performance? And the answer is yes. So when I measured those cache misses, so I had less cache misses, and here is my performance. Higher is better. Sorry, higher is worse. So our cache blocking performed worse, even though we had less cache misses. That seems really weird, because what we know about how processors work is that we have a memory stage, we get a cache miss, and we need to wait for that cache miss. So if we have more cache misses, you know, it should almost certainly be significantly faster. Yes, we're doing a little extra work to keep track of the loop indices, but not, you know, 10%-ish extra work versus what we assume the cost of a cache miss. Because remember, I told you memory is really slow. And it turned out that if I did an optimized version of my loop, so I did some added some optimizations that were unrelated to caching. Optimizations which were just about how I did the arithmetic. It got better. Now cache blocking is faster. But it still seems kind of unimpressive. So the case where cache blocking really helps is when you have a lot of data. And you might say 1,000 by 1,000, that's pretty big. But how much space does a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix of floating point numbers take up? About. Yeah. 64 megs, so why 64? Okay. So it's 64 megabits or 8 megabytes. Yeah. So that would be if I were using doubles. I was actually using floats in this case. So it was 4 megs. So that's actually not that big by modern standards. And in fact, my L3 cache on the machine I was testing on was 8 megabytes. And if you really wanted to see benefits of cache blocking, you needed to go bigger. You need to choose like n equals 2, 4, 6,000. I don't have every single point plotted here because doing this squaring operation on a 5,000 by 5,000 matrix actually takes a while. And measuring every single point from 1 to 10,000 would not be practical. You can see that once we exceed the L3 cache in my system, cache blocking starts really helping. And what this tells us basically is that it's the performance difference between the L3 cache and main memory where I'm really getting into trouble on this problem. That when I was hitting in the L3 cache but probably missing in the L1 and L2 caches, decreasing the number of L1 misses wasn't really helping. Where it really mattered was this higher level cache. And this is probably a common story for cache blocking today when you have something like the problem I showed you where for everything we're loading, we're doing a pretty good amount of computation. If you were doing less computation, then the cache would matter more. So any questions about sort of the performance numbers I'm showing? I'm gonna go into like more detail about the big question is why would it be even worse? Like, how could it be worse depending on how I optimized? But besides that, any questions on what these graphs are showing? Okay. So the optimizations I did were several things. And most of these I didn't like actually do, but I just had, hey compiler, why don't you do some optimization? And it did it. So one, it was reducing the number of loads. So even if it's a cache hit, it's better to use a register. That makes sense, since if you think about how our Y86 processor works, it's faster if you can use a register because you have an extra instruction to load. Real processors have some overhead, even though you think you can write an instruction which accesses a value from memory directly, that's still slower. Another one was figuring out a way to do adds, multiplies with less instructions. We'll talk about this probably after the exam, how that was done. But there's a way of doing less instructions to do the adds and multiplies I need to do. And that was the biggest savings. And another thing was simplifying address computations. So it turned out because doing multiplications and additions is relatively fast that I was actually spending a lot of my time computing particular addresses in A, computing I times N plus J and things like that. And I got a lot of benefit from making that better. Or the compiler got a lot of benefit from making it better. But there's this overarching question of I should still see it be faster when I have less cache misses, so what's happening? And what's happening is that our modern processors do multiple things at once and they can do things out of order. They don't execute every instruction one at a time, but they can just look at the available instructions and execute what's available. And this means that they can do our loads while they're doing computation. So they can look at the loads we need to do and they can do some computation for things that don't depend on that load while they're doing the load. So we'll talk a little more about this either later today or after the exam. But this is what was happening. So basically, I had loads which were taking longer, but they weren't taking longer enough for me to notice. I was spending more time doing multiplying and adding, and my processor was clever enough to figure out how to overlap these two operations, which we don't know how to do, but that's something that real processors can figure out how to do. This is related to that out of order idea I talked about briefly last week. And this is something you'll commonly come across in optimization, especially since processors do things in parallel, is that something is a bottleneck. In this case, how fast my arithmetic was a bottleneck. And when I fixed that, something else became the bottleneck. In this case, how fast my actual loads and stores were. This is a common theme when you're optimizing. You'll be playing this game of whack-a-mole. You'll fix something, and now it won't matter anymore. So we're going to start looking at optimizations in general. So, and we're going to look at more optimizations at a very micro level. So our cache blocking stuff is I have some big problem and I want to organize the computations for that problem overall better. We're going to start looking at things which are at the really small level. Like I have like 15 instructions and I want to change them to run as fast as possible. And to look at this, because you're normal programmers who do not spend time writing assembly all the time, we're going to talk about what compilers do. Because most of the time, you'd like to write something and have the compiler figure it out. So we're going to say, look at what can compilers do and what can't they do. So let's start with by looking at things compilers do. So here's a C function that sums an array. And here's a partial assembly output from GCC without optimizations. This assembly is horrible because there's no optimizations. Like, and by horrible, I mean you would not write assembly this bad if I told you to convert this function to assembly. So here, in this is the loop, part of the loop. The loop loads computes I times 8 to get the offset, where I is stored there. It loads the address of A from the stack, not from a register, but from the stack, adds the offset to it to compute the address in the array we're accessing, then moves that into a register, then adds that to the sum, which it's storing on the stack and not in the register. Then increments I, which it's storing on the stack. Then copies I to EAX and then compares it to big N, which it's storing on the stack. So any improvements you might suggest to this assembly? Yeah, so don't use the stack so much. So GCC, when you don't do optimizations, it uses the stack all the time. That kind of doesn't make sense when you think about how you write assembly by hand, but for a compiler, this is the simplest thing to do. If you use registers, you need to figure out what registers am I using for what. If you use the stack, you can just say, I always use the stack, I never run out of room. So that's why it uses the stack by default. But that's not very efficient, and this, in fact, will run pretty slowly because of that. Fortunately, compilers have optimization options. So here's the code I get if I use GCC version 5.4 with the optimization options minus capital O, lowercase s, which stands for optimize for size. So if I provide this option, the compiler does some real analysis of that code it had and improves it by a lot. In fact, now I can fit the assembly code on one fly. And it does something which is probably much closer to what you would write by hand. It keeps a copy of I in a register. It keeps N in a register. It uses the single instruction way of accessing something from the array, rather than doing the computation in multiple instructions. It uses an increment instruction, and does the straightforward comparison, no talking to the stack and back. So this is, you know, a pretty nice version of it. So any questions on how this assembly code works? Make sense? So the first thing you can do to make your code faster is like turn on some optimizations. And they can do often a pretty good job. In this case, this is clearly much better than the sort of dumb code it generated before. This is also why if you want to read assembly that the compiler generates, I don't recommend turning on some optimizations. Because this is, in addition to being faster assembly, is much more readable. The other assembly takes a while to figure out because you need to figure out what's on the stack everywhere, in addition to being slow and something you'd never actually want to like ship in a software project. So this is one way of optimizing, and GCC, like many compilers, supports multiple optimization options. So another one you can supply is -O2, which is optimization level 2. So previously I was optimizing for size, now I'm saying do level 2, whatever that means. And that gives me code like this, which doesn't quite fit on the slide. So it's longer code, but this is the code GCC is generating because it thinks it's going to be faster than the size optimized code I showed you before. So here we test if it's equal to 0. We have a special case for that. And otherwise, the compiler does this weird trick where it computes the end of A and increments by 8. Why 8? Because that's the size of a log. So the compiler transformed this code to, instead of accessing A of I, to keep a pointer to the current element of A and increment that pointer. So you could have done that by hand, but in fact the compiler has some logic to look for that, look for doing that sort of manipulation of an array and turn it into manipulation of a pointer. Yes?
So it's not just figured out, oh, it's just marching down an adjacent array, so all you need to do is just keep track of one pointer.
Yeah, so it figured out, hey, I'm accessing AI plus 1, AI plus 2, I can just do that with a pointer. So it's avoiding doing the multiply times 8 calculation, even though that's pretty fast, that we were doing before. And the compiler's doing this because its assumption is that this is probably faster. And that's a pretty non-trivial transformation to do, and it figured it out. So compilers can do these nice, clever things, and it's certainly worth having them to try in your code. So any questions about what's happening here? Okay. So, while compilers do a good job, humans and compilers are good at different kinds of optimizations. So there are some things where, you know, if you want to optimize something in some way, yes, you could write assembly by hand, but probably you can just send it to the compiler and it's going to do a pretty good job at certain kinds of optimizations. And you know, some of the things I showed you are that sort. But there are some things which compilers are very bad at, even though they're pretty easy to do by hand. And this is because of some limitations of compilers. So we're going to talk about things which touch on all of these. So one limitation of compilers is that compilers need to generate correct code. So that doesn't seem like a real limitation. But compilers don't understand, or even if they did understand, aren't allowed to take advantage of what your code is meant to do. If there's some corner case that you never care about, for example, if you have code where you don't care if n is 0, the compiler doesn't know that. It has to assume n might be 0, this code better work correctly when n is 0. So for example, here, maybe you don't care about the sum when n is 0. But the compiler still needed to generate this test for that. Because it has no way of knowing you don't care about that. And this comes up in more complicated cases where the compiler, you know, needs to handle weird things you might do, you know, hypothetically, even though if you were reading the code, you would say, no one's ever going to do that. No one cares about that case. So another thing compilers don't do is they don't look into methods. So typically, if you have a call to a method, they're going to say, okay, that's a method which does something, I'm just going to call it. They're not going to know this method does a particular thing, so I can take advantage of that. They just have to assume that the method is some opaque block of code that they need to call and get a return value from. They can't assume anything about how it works. So this is not always true. So there are some times when compilers will look between methods. So if you call a method from another, they'll take advantage of what that method you're calling does to optimize your code. but they often will not do this. And there's sort of two reasons for this. So the biggest limitation is that we have separate compilations. So if you remember, we produced .o files, object files. And if we have two things in separate C files, they produce separate object files. And those object files already contain the machine code. That means the compiler doesn't actually know what the method does if it's in another object file. Because you could replace the object file before you link it with something that does something completely different. And the compiler can't know that. So if you're compiling in that way, where you produce separate object files with machine code, and you combine that into executable, the compiler can't look between object files because each one is generated independently and could be regenerated at any time. Another limitation is performance. So the compiler, when it's optimizing, does things which don't scale very well. And one way the compiler makes compilation times tolerable is it doesn't look at every single possibility. And one way it limits the sort of possibilities it looks at is by not going between function calls. Because if it did that often, it would get into a case where it needs to consider like an exponential number of possibilities for some pattern it's looking for. Like if it's looking for, are you accessing AI, A plus one, A plus two? If it did that across methods arbitrarily, that might explode into looking at like thousands of array accesses or something like that, and might make your compilation times intolerably slow. So a common heuristic for compilers is to only look for optimizations within a function. Because if even though it's straightforward to do it across functions, it might end up having many thousands or hundreds of thousands of cases to look at. So another thing compilers can't do is that they can't always guess what the typical case for your code is. So if a compiler is looking at this code here, it doesn't know if your typical n is like 4 or your typical n is like a million. And you might want to do different things if you imagine your typical n is 4 versus if you imagine your typical n is a million. The compiler needs to guess, and it's not always going to guess right. Another thing compilers can't do is that they can't really understand what your code size versus code speed trade-offs. So you see, when we made this optimization here, this is an optimized version of the code, which is probably faster. But to make it faster, we made our code bigger. And this is going to be true of a lot of optimizations. But if I make all my code bigger, my program might run slower. That's because I have to read the instructions of the program from memory. I only have so much space in my instruction cache. When I run out of that space, reading those instructions is going to end up being slower on average. I'll have more instruction cache misses. I'll have a higher effective memory access time to instructions. And so the compiler doesn't want to do optimizations where it makes all your code really, really big, just in case it's like run a lot. It's going to try to temper what it does in order to avoid, you know, making your binary multiple megabytes, just to try to make each function as fast as possible, because that will end up making the whole thing slower in many cases. So, any questions about these sort of general limitations before we go on to some specific examples? So one of the most nasty problems that compilers face in doing optimizations is something called aliasing. So our book defines aliasing as you have two pointers, and maybe they point to the same place. Usually when people talk about aliasing, they mean it more generally. You have two values, and they could represent the same value. So like you could have a pointer and a value which that pointer might point to or might not. This is another case you might have aliasing. But in either case, the compiler can't do a lot of optimizations which are pretty obvious. So here, you would like the compiler to make this work by multiplying star py times 2. That would be probably what you would do if I told you make this faster. But that is incorrect. A compiler generating correct code can't generate this assembly, which is doing that. That is not actually actually a correct translation of this code. And the reason it's not a correct translation is because, hypothetically, I could call this function with two pointers to the same thing. Now, if you look at the function, you probably say, would you really want to do that? But I hypothetically could do that. And the compiler, you know, because it needs to generate code which handles that case correctly, even though you looking at the code, especially if there were like a comment documenting what this function did, might say, you don't care about that. So what you can do to help the compiler is you can, you know, use some like a temporary variable to tell it, hey, yeah, this is not going to point to something the same. Or you could just expand it out to do the two times star py. That will tell the compiler, yeah, I mean you to do it this way. And obviously, it doesn't need to worry about whether px and py point to the same place if you actually write the alternate code I show there. So this seems pretty contrived, but hopefully it gets across the idea. So the problem here is that, you know, there might be things pointing to the same place, even though we typically don't do that. But the compiler needs to worry about it, because if it doesn't, there's probably going to be some case where you actually intended to have two pointers to the same thing where it matters. And if you were compiling like a 50,000 line program, and your compiler did an optimization where it assumed two pointers didn't point to the same place, and you had a bug from it, you would be very, very angry. And yes, this has happened before. But compilers are really careful about avoiding it. But this seems pretty contrived. Like, this sort of scenario seems like code you wouldn't write. So how would we end up with cases in the real world where aliasing is going to keep the compiler from doing something useful for us? So I have a less contrived case. So this top function has a problem with aliasing that the bottom one doesn't. Can someone describe to me what the compiler needs to be worried about that's going to prevent it from doing, might prevent it from doing optimizations? Anyone have, yeah.
For the top one, right?
Yeah, the top one has the aliasing problem, yes.
Would it be concerned that a result in a matrix would be pointing to the same matrix?
Yeah, so the problem is that result in matrix might be pointers to different parts of the same array. Now, looking at this code, especially since you have a function name, which is telling you what it's doing, that is obviously silly. Like, obviously no one would intentionally call this function that way. But the compiler doesn't get to do natural language processing in your function name. That would be wrong. It has to actually generate code where if result and matrix point to the same thing, or result points to something in the middle of matrix, that it still acts in the correct fashion of like updating summing values that you might be updating at the same time. And so that means that these two pieces of code are not equivalent. And in fact, the compiler is likely to generate slower code for the top version. So what can it do for the bottom version that it can't do for the top? That might be faster. Yeah. Yeah, so in the bottom version, so the answer is it stores sum in the register. So in the bottom version, the compiler can probably do something like add q, you know, access the matrix element into a register. In the top version, it has to do add q into, you know, the result element. So it's doing an extra memory access every iteration of that loop, probably. So it's going to likely to end up being slower. At least that's the straightforward computation. And if you compile these two versions with at least one compiler, it ends up that the version without aliasing is a bit faster. This is cycles per element. So it's more efficient. You have a speed up no matter the size. And that's just because we're doing less memory accesses. Another thing aliasing often does is that in addition to preventing some the simple optimization here of keep the value in a register or not, so this is not in register, this is in register. In addition to that, the compiler might have more optimizations it wants to do, but aliasing is going to make it really hard to do any optimizations. Because when you have aliasing, you can't reorder things. You have if you assume result and matrix could point to the same thing or points to parts of the same thing, you basically have to do all these adds exactly in that order. You can't take any shortcuts. And so this means, for example, this is compiling with O2, optimization level 2. If I do the same thing and compile both versions with O3 for optimization level 3, I get a different picture. It's way faster. And the reason it's way faster is that there's an optimization my compiler is doing where it's doing using instructions which do more adds in one instruction. But in order to do that, it needed to know that it could reorder the adds. But before, it didn't know it could do that. It couldn't do these extra optimizations because it knew less about how it could reorganize the code. So a general pattern that you can have when to help compilers out with aliasing is to reorganize your code like this, to have explicit local variables, because if there's that variable sum, the compiler can tell there's no pointers to it. How can it know that? Because you never took a pointer to it. So it knows there's no pointers to it, so it can keep it in the register. And you can use local variables like that to give a compiler a hint, hey, this value is something you could keep in a register, you don't need to access it from memory all the time. So the compiler could do this itself. So in this case, my compiler, without me using that explicit local variable, couldn't figure out that it could do these extra optimizations with it. It could do a whole lot more. Hypothetically, the compiler could figure this out by generating a check where it says, hey, does result overlap with the matrix? Hypothetically, the compiler could do that. And some compilers might end up doing this, but this is pretty hard for compilers to do. The compiler needs to do some really fancy analysis of what's happening out in the loop to figure out that it's n times n and not something else. That that's actually the maximum index. Like you can kind of figure that out pretty quickly, but that's not a trivial thing to look for because you need to say, are there any cases when I might be bigger than n, and so on. But hypothetically, you might find the compiler doing that, but usually not. Usually, you'll end up with a case where the compiler won't do it, and you'll have a big difference in performance. Okay. So aliasing, I said, it prevents other optimizations. So we saw these. This is optimizations where the compiler just knows a more efficient way of doing arithmetic, but it needs to reorder the adds to do it. Another thing it prevents is cache optimization. So I showed you these two loop orders, and you might say, well, why can't the compiler do that for me? Maybe the compiler knows what the loop order is best. Maybe you could figure that out. And some compilers do try to do this, but it's actually very hard for them to do because of aliasing. Because what happens if B and A point to parts of the same thing? Then if the compiler reorders the loops, it's changed the answer you get. You looking at this code know probably B and A aren't the same thing. But the compiler doesn't know that and needs to generate correct code in either case. And so this is a big reason why sort of cache optimizations like this, you often have to do them by hand. even if you could imagine the compiler knowing how to do that. Because the compiler doesn't have enough information about what you're doing to figure out that there's things in fact do not overlap. In addition to the problem of B and A being the same thing, it's even tricky for the compiler to figure out that, say, that the different parts of A like aren't the same thing or not, if that would be relevant. Okay. So I mentioned about avoiding aliasing, and the things aliasing prevents. So one case where avoiding aliasing comes up is when you're writing sort of code like I showed you for cache blocking. So there, I mentioned that we had really good locality in some of the AI case, that we were using the same value over and over again. But if we use our natural code that we started with, use this code here, we're probably going to end up loading each thing from A and A each time in that loop. Even though the compiler, you know, might guess that it's the same thing, because of aliasing, the compiler has to assume maybe AI times N plus K is the same thing as BI times N plus J. Maybe that's the case. Therefore, I need to reload I times N plus K each time. So, but you don't actually need to do that. We can write code where we tell the compiler that, hey, I'm going to be loading AI times N plus K once, and I'd like you to use it over and over again. It's the same value, I promise. This is what we're telling the compiler. Because I'm loading it up here, it knows that I'm not, it doesn't, knows that these writes to be can't be affecting it, because I'm telling it load the value before those writes to be anyways. And I'm doing the same for several other values from A. And the hope is that if I write my code this way, I'm going to force the compiler to load those values earlier. And because there's so few of them, it can keep them all in registers. And that way, the compiler will avoid loading values repeatedly from memory. So even though loading values repeatedly from memory is going to be cache hits every time, cache hits are still more expensive than reading registers. And so this style of code is something people will often do for things like matrix operations. It's called often register blocking. It's like cache blocking. In cache blocking, you choose what values you want in the cache. Here, we're choosing what values we want in registers. And we're doing that by telling the compiler with this hint that I want these values loaded, which hopefully lets the compiler figure out that it can keep them in registers, even though I'm writing to memory that might have been the same memory. And so there's this general pattern when you have any sort of repeated load that you want to do, because aliasing is a concern, which is you just move the load outside the loop and create a variable. When you create this variable, this local variable, which you never take a pointer to, the compiler knows there's no aliasing because there's no pointers to it. And it's very easy for the compiler to see you never take a pointer to a variable. It's very hard for a compiler to see these two arrays don't overlap that you have pointers to. So aliasing, you know, one thing you can avoid. And all the mechanisms we have for avoiding it are either rewrite the code to have the order of operations you want, or rewrite the code to have these extra local variables to tell the compiler that you want these values in registers, you want them loaded beforehand, and so on. C has an attempt to let you tell the compiler explicitly, hey, I promise this pointer doesn't alias anything. It exists, it's called restrict, and you maybe the compiler would do this optimization itself. In practice, when I've tried it, it rarely helps. Compilers are pretty bad at taking advantage of this hint. But it exists, you might see it somewhere. But generally, you're better off doing things like this. I note that a disadvantage to doing things like this is that what happens if I make too many variables? What happens if I, instead of having AI 0, AI 1, let's say I go up to AI like 100, what's going to happen? Yeah? Yeah, so a round of registers, but because I'm loading them beforehand, and it doesn't know that it can load them later because I'm writing to B, it's going to put them somewhere else in memory, probably on the stack. So if you do too much of this, you might make the code slower because the compiler is going to copy it from the array to the stack and then read from the stack repeatedly. So any questions about aliasing in general? Okay, so aliasing is one thing we avoid. So let's talk about the biggest case of the problem with compilers optimizing mostly a method at a time. So usually their procedures, they look at a method and they optimize it. And here's some code which we have this add with limit function. So it takes two numbers, adds them together. If the result is greater than 10,000, it makes the result 10,000. It's a reasonable utility function. I might want to use that elsewhere. And I'm just going to call it repeatedly in my loop to sum up this array. And if the compiler is optimizing a method at a time, what it's going to do here is it's going to generate a function call. So what does a function call for this look like? What do we have to have? There's one thing which is really, really obvious we have to have in the assembly for this. A call instruction. So that's one thing. So here we have a call. What else do we have to have? So there's a ret in here. Anything else that, yeah. So you might need to save some stuff to the stack. So you might push registers. Anything else you might have to do? Yeah. So we have to move values to the parameter register. So you might have to move something like from, you know, BX to RSI, because that's where the argument for this function is going to be. So we have a whole bunch of extra instructions we're adding to our code and executing in this loop that are just about calling this function, that aren't actually about any of the computation in this function. You know, so we at least have two moves, a call and a ret. Some people also mentioned, you know, plus saving registers and restoring registers, because we might have to say, you know, there might be registers we're using, which we promise functions we call we don't use. So we save those values. And so this can make things slower, because we're just executing more instructions. The processor needs to spend some time doing the work of the call instruction and the return instruction and the various move instructions. So what we can do instead is just copy the body of the function into the loop. And that's going to get rid of the function, all that function call overhead. And for a function like this, which probably turns into like three-ish instructions as far as the actual body, that could be a pretty big win, because we're executing like three plus extra instructions just to execute these three instructions. Why don't we just put those three instructions in the loop? So this is something which, you know, you could do by hand. And since I've told you the compiler doesn't look between methods, it wouldn't be doing that. If the compiler only looks a method at a time, it's going to optimize this sum method, the original sum method. It's going to optimize the add with limit method. It's not actually going to be able to look between them to do anything. And there's a disadvantage to inlining. So it's not always faster, but it is, it's often better because you get rid of those extra instructions, and you also let the compiler use more registers because you don't have to like save registers, or at least you save the work of saving and restoring registers. It also can help out the compiler because, like with aliasing, it knows more about what's going on, so it might be able to apply extra optimizations it couldn't apply before. It has, like, it can understand better, like, if operations can be reordered and things like that. But it's not always faster, and the big reason why you wouldn't always want to inline absolutely everything is this makes your code bigger. And as I mentioned, compilers don't understand when it can make your code bigger or not, but if you always made your code bigger, very big, you'd run out of space in your instruction cache. And that could make your program slower. So if you do a lot of this, especially for a big function, and you have like lots of loops where you call that function, you could end up making your program a lot slower because you spend a lot of time reading instructions into the instruction cache, which you wouldn't be doing before. Whereas if you call the function repeatedly from lots of places, it's going to stay in the cache. It's actually going to be faster, even though you have those extra instructions to call it and return from it. So that's a disadvantage of inlining. And it's important to understand that there's an advantage because compilers can actually do inlining and will actually do inlining. But they don't do it a lot because they're worried about making code bigger. Because if they did it all the time, or even a lot of the time, they'd make your executable so big that you'd actually end up having them be slower. So they're usually pretty conservative about it. So there's some cases where they will like definitely inline. So if you have a really, really short function, like your function consists of just a return statement, the compiler will probably inline that. If you have a function that's called exactly once, the compiler will probably inline that because it's pretty sure that it's not expanding the code by too much. Compilers generally can't inline across object files, and that's because I could change the C file that made that object file, and then the code I generated, which inlined the function elsewhere, is invalid. That's not acceptable. Compiler can't look at that code. So you can, I say usually, because you can convince compilers to do this, but the way that works basically is the compiler writes into the assembly, into the object files, not machine code, but like basically something equivalent to the source code. And the linker does the inlining. But that's a lot slower. So typically, they'll just want inline across .o files. So if you have a function in another file, and you want it inlined, you're going to need to copy it in yourself. And as I mentioned, some compilers let you control inlining. So for example, GCC has something special you can add which says, hey GCC, I want you to really, really try to inline this function. Yes, I know it's kind of big, but really I want you to do that. Or hey GCC, I never want you to inline this function. I know it's really small and simple, but really don't do it. And that might be helpful, but these aren't like standard C. So any questions about inlining, when compilers may or may not do it? Okay. So related to inlining is an issue of redundant operations. So this is similar to an example in our book. So what's wrong from a performance perspective with this code? So the problem we're going to deal with has to do with this stringlen call. So we have a call to stringlen here. We're doing it on every loop iteration. So one thing you might say is, well, first of all, we're calling stringlen, maybe you can inline that. Let's assume the compiler can do that. doing it on every loop iteration. So what's the problem with that? Yeah.
It's the same number every time.
So it's the same number every time. But we're calling it every loop iteration. So you might say, well, maybe the compiler can figure out it's the same number every time. And that might be true. But to do that, first of all, the compiler needs to know what stringlen does. So it like needs to like be able to inline it in order to do that. Secondly, it needs to look at absolutely everything in this loop and figure out that that has nothing to do with modifying string. In this case, maybe that's practical. If the loop was a little more complicated, it could easily be very hard. So generally, the compiler probably won't be able to figure that out and will call stringlen on every iteration of the loop. Because it doesn't know what stringlen does with string, doesn't know that incrementing count isn't going to change that, and it's pretty hard for it to do the analysis to figure that out, even though for you and me, I can read this code and say, yeah, stringlen's the same every time. So if you do something like this, you'll typically get a big improvement. Because you're saying to the compiler, hey, compute the stringlen, store it somewhere, and then access that repeatedly. And that somewhere almost certainly ends up being a register, and this code will often be a lot faster, just because the compiler can't figure out this on its own. And this is an example of the sort of optimization compilers have real trouble with, both because they can't look inside the stringlen function very easily, and because in order to know that this is correct, the compilers need to understand absolutely every statement in the loop. Which quickly becomes infeasible if you have a complicated loop. Especially a loop with like a function call. And this is something I mentioned mainly because as far as optimizations go, this is a big O improvement. And pretty much everything else we're talking about isn't. It's like 2 to 3 times faster, but it's not like quadratic versus linear. This is quadratic versus linear. And if your code is doing this, you'll get the most bang by fixing this sort of problem. There's another sort of redundant operation. So here we're computing the length over and over again. There's another more subtle sort of redundant operations, which are not big O improvements. Might occur if you have, say, a loop like this. So what's a way I could reorganize this to do less work? So you see this loop, we copy the source offset by amount until we get to the end of the source, in which case we copy the end of source repeatedly. And as I mentioned, we're doing this comparison here over and over again. So what could we do to avoid that, doing that as much? Yeah. Yeah, so we could first test, we could pre-compute n minus amount. So that would probably be a little bit of a savings. That's probably something the compiler maybe could figure out. Is there some way, so then we're still doing the same number of comparisons. So some way you can actually do less comparisons. So here, every iteration of the loop, we're checking if I is less than n. And if I is less than, in your case, now n minus amount. Can we do even better than that? Yeah. Okay, so we want to move the comparison into the for loop. And that seems like a good idea. So if we move it into the for loop, then we, and we can handle the first case. So we have, there's this sort of reorganization we can do. So we do a version with a for loop where we check n minus amount, and then where we check n for the remaining things. This is effectively moving into the for loop. And now we're doing just less comparisons. So this is a relatively simple transformation, and it reduces the number of operations. And maybe the compiler could figure this out, maybe it couldn't. And something I note about doing this is that in addition to eliminating that comparison, this sort of change might help the compiler out. Because now the compiler has two simpler loops. So here we have this loop, which has one statement in it, which does the same thing each time. And if you remember, compilers do things like convert accesses to an array at an index to accesses in an array at a pointer. Now that's easier for the compiler to do because the loop is simpler. And there's other things compilers will do with loops, which when the loop is simpler, it's easier for them to figure out. So this can also help out the compiler in other ways. Okay. So speaking of loops, so there's one type of optimizations which compilers could do, but often don't. That's kind of like inlining, called loop unrolling. So loop unrolling is I want to execute loop, makes loops more efficient. So here's an example of loop unrolling. So I have a loop where I add a value to rex every iteration of the loop. So I'm going to change it to a loop where I add two values to rex every iteration of the loop. So this bottom loop does twice as much work with only one extra instruction. And so that can be a lot faster. And the reason is I have a lot of instructions in my loop, especially a simple loop like this, are not really about doing the work. I'm doing the comparisons to see if I'm done. I'm doing arithmetic to maintain my loop index. But for the most part, it's not actually the computations I care about. So I can do more of the computations I care about for iteration of the loop. So are these always equivalent? So here, I'm checking if I'm done by comparing EDX to ESI. ESI is my loop index, then I'm using my loop index to access an array. Loop index to access an array. And in this case, I'm checking my loop index to see if I'm done, using my loop index to access an array, access the next element of the array, then checking if I'm done, and so on. So is there a case where these two pieces of code aren't the same?
The size of the array is odd.
Yeah, so the size of the array is odd. With this code, I'm doing something I shouldn't be doing. I'm doing either an extra piece of arithmetic or one less piece of arithmetic than I should be doing. So to deal with that in practice, this is sort of the C code version of that, just to save space on assembling because it's easy to read. You're going to have some extra code at the end to handle the leftover. But assuming n is pretty big, that extra code is not going to be a big deal. And if you some reason know that n is a multiple of 2, then you don't need it. So this is our general, what the equivalent C code is, and that I showed you the assembly. And this is just does a lot more work with fewer instructions, so typically will be faster. Yes?
Why would you ever want to do this?
In C, or?
In C, yeah. What does this buy you, this loop unrolling?
So hopefully our compiler, this will tell our compiler to generate the second version, which is faster. So this is about, this is what we want our compiler to do. Will this make our compiler do it? Hard to say. But probably, because that's the most easiest thing for the compiler to do. And so by doing this loop unrolling, we say it's 6 instructions doing the work that previously we executed 10 instructions to do, in this case. And we can do more of this. So instead of incrementing by just 2, we could do 4 at a time. In which case, we'll get a bit more savings. We'll have 2 extra instructions, and we'll be doing twice as much work. So there is this question of, why would we do this? And I assume like the assumption underlying that is, can't the compiler do this for us? Like, this is very, very mechanical. And that seems like the kind of thing a software program would be pretty good at doing. And it is actually easy for compilers to do, but they don't do very much of it, typically. So what's wrong that keeps compilers from doing loop unrolling a lot? Why would compilers not want to do it all the time? Back there?
I guess because they don't know what the, like for example, what the end input would be, so they don't know if, like, if it's going to be worth it.
Yeah, so when you do loop unrolling, you have this extra stuff to handle the end case, and also you're making your code bigger. And you don't even know that the n is ever big enough that this matters. Like, if our n is typically 16, we're adding a whole bunch of extra code, we're making our program bigger, we're gonna have more instruction cache misses, and we're adding this extra logic that may well not be worthwhile for it, you know, if n is 16. And the compiler typically doesn't have a way of knowing that this n is really, really big and this n is really, really small. So because they're concerned that, you know, maybe there's a small number of iterations and it could exceed instructions, that says compilers are pretty conservative about actually doing loop unrolling. So they'll do it for some small loops. They'll do it at the higher optimization levels sometimes. So this is one of the things that the O3 and O2 options are different on. The O3 option is going to guess more often that your loop does not have a small number of iterations than O2. This means that O3 can be slower than O2, because that guess can be wrong. But that's sort of the sort of guess you might make. But compilers are generally pretty conservative about it, because they're going to be worried, you know, I'm making this code much bigger. Is that actually going to be worthwhile for this loop? Is this loop actually important? Okay, I probably should not go on to my next topic. So we'll save that until after the exam, I guess. But first, so next class is review. If you do not have questions, it will be a very short class. I assume you have questions. Also, since I have 2 minutes left in class, I will take any questions you have about the current homework assignment. Yes? The lab solution, yes, I intend to do that sometime later today. Any other questions about our current homework assignment or pipelining in general? Yes?
Not about pipelining or homework, but on the last slide, where we were talking about like loop unrolling, if a loop gets used multiple times and it's set by like a variable, how far it goes, would unroll one instance of the loop and not another?
So what the question is, will the compiler unroll one instance of a loop and not another? So most of the optimizations that compilers do are based on heuristics. Like, someone came up with a guess as to when loop unrolling is good. And they just like made a guess. It's really a guess. Like, I assume loop unrolling is good if the loop has like less than 10 instructions and maybe some other things are true. And those heuristics may or may not apply in different cases, even if it's the same loop code in different functions, for example. It depends on the compiler. But it's mostly sort of guesses as to when this type of optimization is good. You know, and usually they want to make those guesses things which are almost always right. So other questions either about homework or anything I covered today? not see you next time. Have questions about the town?